specialist, Harris called after her. You know, it took me more than half an hour to find you two. This isn't the Garden of Eden, this is a damned war zone. She shouted something back, but I didn't catch it. Harris reached down and hauled me to my feet. I wanted to push him into the lake, but restrained myself. His sense of humor didn't extend that far.
Sorry, vet, I said.
Won't happen again.
Bullshit. I know your kind, McGill. You latch onto every piece of tail that comes into range. Now get your ass back to the lifter. We're gathering up the unit and marching on the colonist stronghold tonight.
We began the trek back to the lifter. As we walked, I began getting worried.
You said something about a war zone, I said. No one's attacked the colonists yet, have they? No reprisals, no diplomatic incidents?
I looked at him meaningfully, as I knew he was perfectly capable of causing a diplomatic incident if he was in the mood.
Nope. That's your job, McGill.
What are you talking about?
You made contact the first time, remember?
He said, grinning at me.
The Primus nominated you for round two. We're sending you in to negotiate surrender conditions with the colonists.
What happens if I can't do that?
Harris's grin grew a fraction wider.
Then it's boom time for our little arrow-shooting friends. No more man-traps or picking off patrols. They're a menace, and they've got to learn who's in command on this rock. The Centurion will tell you all about it.
When we got back to base camp around the lifter, I met up with Centurion Graves. He waved me close and walked away from the rest of the troops who'd built up a fire base with a perimeter of low puffcrete walls. We didn't have a lot of extra material for a really big wall. Those supplies had been lost with Corvus.
McGill, you're just the man I want to talk to. Where the hell have you been?
I glanced back at Harris, who made kissing faces at both of us.
Ah, said Graves. I get it. Pretty ballsy of you to pull a stunt like that, right after a revive. You feeling up for a new mission?
Would it matter if I wasn't?
Not in the least.
I'm operating at 110%, sir.
Good, he said. Let's go over the game plan.
As he spoke, he walked me out of earshot of the rest of the unit. Harris lost interest and went to harass Carlos, who was trying to catch more rockfish with a nanite string on his finger. He'd gotten one of the techs to make a wriggling lure, which he'd attached to the end and now was reeling them in every few minutes.
What's my mission, sir?
I asked Graves.
You're going to penetrate their defenses as you did before. They speak English, right?
They do, sir, but with an odd accent.
Good. You're to deliver the ultimatum and return to our unit, which will be hiding about a kilometer from that shitty rock pile they like to hide under.
What's the nature of this ultimatum, sir?
Simple enough. They must march out of hiding and surrender their weapons by dumping them on the beach, then walk to our lines with their hands on their heads. After that,
sir, I said, interrupting, I've talked to these people. I think it's highly unlikely they will...
I'm not going to candy this one up, he said, cutting off my protest. The orders are unreasonable. In fact, I think they're damn near impossible to execute.
I stared at him, trying to recall an occasion when he'd candied up anything. My mind drew a blank.
But you're a smart boy, he continued. You've already figured out that you're supposed to fail. If you want, you can walk up there, hide in the boulders for half an hour or so, then run back to our lines. I wouldn't blame you. The results will most likely be the same either way.
I straightened my spine. No, sir. I'll deliver the message. But I have to point out that these people are civilians. They're human civvies. And we should be protecting them, not threatening and killing them.
They seem human enough, I'll give you that one. But they aren't officially citizens of Earth. They're wild humans, out of control and unaware they live in the shadow of the Empire. Look, you have to understand what's at stake, and you have to try to explain it to them if you want to save them.
I've heard that line of reasoning before. Why do we have to mess with them at all? Let's just leave them alone. When a rescue ship comes, we'll leave and forget about them.
It won't work that way, soldier, said a voice in the growing darkness.
Graves and I turned to see a man wearing a cloak walk up to us. He didn't wear full battle armor as I did, but he did have on a breastplate and an ornate sidearm.
"Tribune," Graves said, "you honor us with your presence."
"Take a walk, Centurion." Without another word, Graves turned on his heel and headed back toward the shimmering lake and the scattered campfires. Men were toasting up rockfish and dousing the meat with alkaline solutions to leach out the toxins.
"We can't leave them alone, McGill," Tribune Drusus told me. "The Empire will blame us for whatever these people do once they've been discovered. And they will be discovered when the Galactics come to pick us up. We had to report the attack upon our vessel to Regional Command. When the Galactics return, they will come in force."
"The battle fleet?" I asked in awe. Drusus nodded.
"Perhaps not right away. But a violation of this magnitude can't be ignored. They'll have to come and expunge all disobedient life from these worlds. The cephalopods are as good as dead, even if they don't know it. Knowing what's coming, our mission has changed. Instead of worrying about putting down a possible revival, I'm here to ensure that Earth isn't going to be somehow blamed for what's happened here."
"I understand that, sir. Maybe if we took our time and talked to the colonists gently, we could win their trust over a period of
hours," Drusus finished for me. "That's how long we have. The Galactics have military-grade warp drives. They might be far from here, but we can't take that chance. Really, we should pulverize these Warrens with an immediate bombardment. But I've decided to give them one last chance."
"Hours? But the Galactics aren't likely to come that fast. They'll probably take months to arrive."
"Yes, but then again, they might not. It is imperative that we have this situation resolved before they arrive."
"You're willing to kill an entire population of your own people just because the battle fleet might be nearby? May I remind you, sir, that these people don't have revival machines. Every one of them we kill will be permed."
"I know that. But I also know the Galactics are as heartless as the stars themselves. The threat they represent forces my hand. I have to protect the Legion, and I have to protect Earth."
"Can I ask one more question, Tribune?"
"Why me?"
"Because you at least managed to talk to them for a while before they became violent. I think it was the adaptation of removing your armor that saved you. Can you explain that choice to me?"
I thought about it.
"Yes, sir. I didn't want to look threatening, so I stripped down to look more like one of them. They seemed to fear armored men. They said something about me having litter mates, and they doubted I was even human at first. I don't know what to make of it."
"Strange. Maybe they've developed superstitious beliefs. They've been cut off from Earth for quite a while, and they've obviously diverged from the rest of us, culturally.
Am I to understand that I'm the last attempt we're making at diplomatic contact?"
"Yes."
I mulled that one over for a second. I didn't like the situation at all. I'd never considered myself to be good at diplomacy, except possibly when it came to getting myself laid. Other than that, I'd always failed miserably at negotiating anything. Most people found me abrasive and difficult to deal with. Maybe that was the real reason they were sending me. I was expected to fail.
I didn't see any way out of my situation. The colonists were slated for death, and I had to do what I could to help them out. The poor bastards probably had no idea what an Earth Legion could do to them.
"I understand, sir," I said at last. "I'll do my best."
"I know that you will."
The Tribune left then, vanishing into the dark. Most soldiers wore identifying lights around the camp at night and used lamps to see. But not Drusus. He walked like a ghost among the rest of us. An hour later, I found myself picking my way through loose gravel toward the hulking boulders in the dark.
I shed my armor and left my cannon at the base of the first big rock I came to. I then went on with only a shoulder lamp and my sidearm. Going completely unarmed would probably have been best, but I couldn't bring myself to do that. I'd already decided that if that rat-faced guy Stott showed up with his crossbow, I was going to kill him if at all possible, diplomacy be damned. For a while I felt like I was grunting and climbing among the boulders alone, but I knew that this time there were buzzards nearby. There were insects on Dust World, plenty of them, but our buzzards sounded different from the native species. Their black polymer wings made a tiny clicking noise that I found distinctive. The Legion techs were watching me. Natasha herself was probably playing the vid feed inside her helmet. Feeling a little self-conscious, I came to the area where Gorman had bought the proverbial farm. I stepped carefully from there on, staying on top of the widest, flattest rocks and avoiding loose dirt. I heard another kind of click about 100 meters farther in. It was a sound that made my skin crawl. It was the sound of a crossbow string being drawn back and loaded with deadly bolt. Halting, I put my hands over my head. "I'm here to talk," I said loudly.
"You people don't learn, do you?" asked a female voice.
"Della?" She stayed quiet for a second, then I heard a soft thudding of feet as she circled around me. She was almost invisible in the rocks. I tried not to flinch, and I almost managed it as she brought the tip of her weapon under my chin. She reached out and turned my shoulder lamp upward to shine upon my face. She gasped.
"You are a littermate," she exclaimed. "I didn't believe they could do this. I didn't want to believe."
"Hold on," I said, sensing that she was about to shoot me. "Can you at least tell me what a littermate is? I don't have a clue."
"Pretense of ignorance will fool no one. I've patrolled these stones since I was little. I know them better than anyone alive. You can't fool a scout. I'm surprised you would even try."
I sensed she was proud of her accomplishments and her title. I filed that information away, trying to think fast. I had no desire to be revived twice in a single day. It would make Harris far too happy.
"Look," I said, "I'm no littermate, if you mean some kind of clone. If I was a clone, how could I know your name? You killed me last time, remember? How would I know that?"
She circled, and I sensed indecision.
"You made a mistake coming back here. Whatever you are, abominations will always die in Happy Valley."
"Happy Valley?"
"That's our name for this place, if it matters to you."
"Look, Della, I just came back for one thing. Give it to me and I'll go."
She didn't speak for a moment.
"What is it you want?"
"My knife," I said. "Remember? My dad gave it to me. I told you I'd come back for it."
Chapter 16. I stood with my hands on my head. I wasn't even looking at the girl that stepped around me like a bobcat circling a rabbit hole. I didn't dare.
"You can't have your knife," she said. "It isn't possible that such a valuable thing is yours. You've stolen it. Taken it from our ship, perhaps."
"Your ship? Where is it?"
She moved, and the tip of her crossbow bolt came up to touch my neck. I pulled away fractionally, but she pressed it closer. I knew the tip of the bolt was made of nanites that twisted and churned in a locked pose, wanting to break their formation as a sharp point and transform into a swarm that would dig through my flesh.
"I'm no child," she said. "You will get no information from me, not even if you were the one with the bolt at my throat."
"I'm not here to spy on you," I said, trying to sound as nonchalant as I could.
"Then why do you come here?"
she asked a moment later, almost sounding exasperated.
"Why do you torment me at my patrol spot? Why not attack or ignore us? Always before, your kind has done exactly the same thing. You march from your ships, you line up, and you hunt for game, nothing else. Why talk now?
I glanced at her, not knowing what she was talking about. She still seemed to think I was someone else. I wondered if there might be another group of colonists that preyed on these people. That would explain a lot.
I'm talking about trying to save you, I said. There's a great threat, and you don't have long to live if you don't listen.
She laughed. She shook her long, fine hair, and I felt it brush my arms.
I'm the one who holds your life in my hands.
I shook my head.
You can't kill me. Not really. I'll come back again and again.
How do you do that?
We have a machine aboard our ship. It has the power to rebuild our bodies after we die. Our cells are copied, our minds too, and we live again.
Della moved in front of me and her head cocked to one side. I could tell she was intrigued.
Your lies are complex and bizarre. Let's pretend I believe you have the power of a god. Why does a god care about me?
My name is James McGill, I said. I'm a specialist. A weaponeer, to be precise, in an organization called Legion Varus. I'm part of Earth's space-going military. I know who you are. All of you people are descendants of colonists from Earth. A lost people who...
Della grabbed me by the ear then. I couldn't remember the last time a woman had done that. I think it must have been my grandma after I'd painted her cat with some varnish I'd found out in her barn. Being dragged by the ear hadn't felt good as a kid, and it didn't feel good now. I was pulled along by her, stumbling over the rocks. She kept her crossbow aimed at me, and I had to admit it made me nervous. One slip of her finger would send that bolt right through me. Even if she just bumped the point into my flesh, the nanites might go crazy at the taste of blood and worm their way into my organs to feed. Della dragged me to a spot I thought looked familiar. I eyed the place, and I recognized the wide, dark stain on the flattest part of the rock.
You know what this is?
She asked.
My blood?
Your life was spilled out and taken from you.
Where's the body? I asked. She looked at me with narrowed eyes.
You want to see it? Why? Are you a sorcerer who will bring it back to life? If so, I'll kill you both again and use your knife to chop up the pieces.
Won't matter, I said. I'll come back anyway. Puffing with anger, she dragged me again. I knew I could take her this time. She was getting a little careless. I'd never shown her any of my moves, and I knew if I could push away the crossbow, I'd be able to throw her off her feet. She couldn't weigh more than half what I did. With any luck, I'd put her down before she could react. It would be a risk, but I was becoming annoyed with her attitude. I felt my body tense up, my mind planning my moves. But I had to stop myself. This was supposed to be a diplomatic mission. I had to put up with her nonsense to win her trust. Tripping her onto her face and sitting on her would be satisfying. But it wasn't going to win me the Nobel Peace Prize. We finally halted. Together we stared at a corpse that lay face down on a large flat rock. He was a tall guy with blonde hair and a hole in his back. A great deal of blood had leaked out of the body, and the clothes had largely been stripped away. My skin crawled to see myself dead at my own feet. I'd never had that experience before. I'd died several times, but I'd never had to bury myself. For the mental health of our troops, it was a general rule that legionnaires were excused from dealing with their own dead bodies, if at all possible.
That was me, I said. It's weird to see myself lying there. I've never looked at my own corpse before.
Della watched me.
You don't mourn, she said. You don't pray.
I shook my head. We only do that when we've been permed. When we've died somehow and can't be returned to life.
How many times can you come back from death?
I shrugged. How many times can you make a new crossbow bolt out of nanites? She narrowed her eyes and looked at the tip of her bolt.
Until we run out of nanites, or our Fletchers die, or our lathes no longer work.
I nodded. It's the same with us. Della reached down between her breasts and into her tunic. She fished around in there, and I got the feeling she had a pocket inside to stash objects. I tried not to be obvious as I stared at her tanned breasts, revealed in flashes, but she didn't seem to mind or even be aware of my scrutiny. She pulled her hand back out and held my knife in her palm, still in its sheath. She handed it to me.
No one has ever gone through so much to revive something so small, she said. You've earned this before you are slain again.
I took the knife.
Thanks. As I said, my dad gave it to me back home. Home, she said slowly. You still claim to come from Earth?
Yes. From Georgia. North America sector, to be exact.
You profane Earth with your lies. You come from a brood mother. You are artificial, bred by the cephalopods in vats. We know these things to be true. Whatever your real purpose is, know that you have failed, creature.
Bred in vats? I found this idea confusing. But I didn't have time to mull it over now. I'm not an intuitive man, but I sensed that things weren't going my way. She was thinking about killing me again. Look, I said, why don't you just come down the hill to the lake shore? Talk to my commanders. We won't harm you. We want peace with your people because you are our people. We want you to rejoin your own species.
You might even believe what you say is true,
she said almost wistfully.
And in truth, I find myself attracted to your mind and body. You're not like the other men I've known, but you'll not lure me away from my post. The idea is absurd.
I sighed. Then I failed. I'll tell you what's going to happen next. Heavy weapons will be brought up. They'll have explosives and maybe gas. Drones will be sent in, and men in armor. You'll all die here, and hiding in your tunnels won't save you.
You threaten us, after all this talk of peace?
A weapon, which had strayed a fraction off target, now began to move back toward my neck. I decided to act. There wasn't going to be another chance. I slammed the crossbow away. We struggled for an instant, and she bit my shoulder. I reached down and pressed her finger on the trigger of the crossbow. The bolt fired off into the sky, hissing. A quick sweep of my leg under her ankles brought her down. She looked up at me, stunned. I leaned forward.
You'll kill me now, she said, proving your words were all lies. Why did you bother to try to fool me?
I wasn't lying, and I'm not going to kill you. I'm your last chance for life, in fact. Come with me, and we'll talk further. A blade appeared in her hand. The metal edge had a black, wet look to it that I recognized from the tip of her bolts. I sprang away. She scrambled to her feet and fled, crying out for her comrades. I looked after her, but I knew I couldn't chase her down. There were too many man-traps, and her friends were sure to kill me the second they saw me pursuing her. Della, I shouted. I'm sorry. Run out into the desert when the bombs come. Maybe they'll miss some of you. I turned then and ran downhill the way I'd come. Rocks shifted and slid from under my boots, and any second I expected to be consumed by a patch of innocent-looking gravel to die screeching in the dark like Gorman.
Command isn't easy, McGill, Graves told me. It's best that you learn that right now.
I didn't even look at him. I didn't care about his subtle hints at promotion. I didn't want a promotion. I wanted the colonists in this little green valley to survive to see another morning.
In light of your recent actions, Graves said, I'm not sending you on the mop-up mission. You're to report back to the lifter under Leeson's command. Keep that ship safe for me. All supplies are aboard her.
I scoffed. I knew I was being shunted aside. I wondered what kind of whining Harris and Leeson had done to get out of attacking the rock pile themselves. Probably they feared going in there to clean the place out. Bombs and plasma grenades could only do so much. We didn't have a single heavy artillery piece from the arsenal. We'd left the big stuff on Corvus, and it was certain we'd be down to poking around in tunnels up close and personal by the end of this disgusting mission. "Permission ahead of the lifter, sir?" I asked.
"Get to your platoon and tell Leeson to move out. And one more thing, McGill."
"What's that, sir?"
"Quit moping like someone ran over your puppy. This is our job. Legion Varus never gets the easy missions."
"I've got that clear in my head now, sir."
"See that you stay on target. Dismissed."
I trudged away, not even having the heart to grumble. I found Carlos, or rather he found me.
"You nailed her, didn't you?"
he asked, studying me. "What are you talking about?"
"The wild chick with the crossbow. Who else?"
I didn't say anything for a second, keeping a poker face. I knew this would set him off.
"I knew it!"
Carlos exclaimed, extending an accusing finger.
"I could see it in your eyes. These colonist chicks are cut off from real men. They've got to be hot for it. I knew it the minute I heard about this place."
"So why aren't you up there on those rocks making your play?" I asked him. "Go up there naked. They like that best." Carlos didn't seem to be listening. He shook his head and chided himself.
"This just proves it," he said. "My problem is I don't act on my hunches as fast and as naturally as you do. I'm not 90% animal. I'll be the first to admit it, and I think that's my greatest character flaw. I salute you, McGill. For a farm boy, you have all the right moves with the ladies."
I didn't feel like explaining anything about what really happened on the rocks, so I went to find Leeson instead. I relayed Graves' orders. Leeson was all smiles. Retreating to a defensive position had to be what he wanted all along. Why sweat and fight crazies hiding under rocks when you could sip green fizzies in the shade of the lifter ramps? We set off immediately, heading back along the lake shore toward the lifter. I barely had time to put my armor on. It was pitch dark, and we only had our night vision systems and a few suit lamps to go by. On Dust World, there was no moon to light up the sky. When night fell, it was as if you had a thick blanket pulled over your eyes. The effect was intensified by the fact we were a few kilometers down in a hole below the desolate surface. Very little starlight penetrated from the distant skies above. Our night vision systems were helpful, but less than perfect. We stumbled over objects that didn't register as solid to the computers inside our helmets. Carlos fell flat on his face in front of me at one point. I laughed, but then hustled forward when he didn't get back up. "You okay?" I asked, grabbing his shoulder. He didn't answer. Instead, he shivered, his entire body spasming. I let go of his shoulder and unlimbered my weapon. "Man down!" I shouted over the unit channel.
"I repeat, we've got..."
"Make for the lifter," Leeson ordered.
"We're under attack!"
I heard a series of snaps and whistling sounds. I knew what they were, and I began running up the lake shore. I didn't like leaving Carlos, but he was probably as good as dead. Ahead of us, the lifter was a dark hulk. It was slightly greenish in my night vision faceplate, as the ship had a hotter heat signature than the vegetation or the stone cliffs behind it. I wondered if I'd reached the ramp before I was shot in the back. I wondered, too, if Della was among those who were attacking us. Chapter 17. The colonists had decided not to wait around for us to attack them. They'd gotten ahead of us and reached the lifter somehow. I suspected they had tunnels worming through the rock walls of this canyon and had been watching us all along. Running toward the lifter in my heavy armor, my boots sank into the sandy soil along the lakeshore with every step. Clumps of earth and vegetation squirted from under my heavy tread as I crashed along. Being a heavy trooper was kind of like driving a very small tank. You felt isolated from your surroundings, but not invincible. At least once, a bolt spanged off my armor. It didn't find a crease or a joint to penetrate, fortunately, and the nanites dribbled off. They couldn't eat through solid steel. When I came to the ramp, I was horrified by what I saw.
A dozen dead Legion regulars lay around the foot of the massive tongue of steel. I knew this was a very bad sign. Normally, the first action the crew would have taken would have been to button up the ship. But the ramp wasn't moving, and there were no signs of life. Gauntlets struck my back and shoved me. I stumbled forward, servos whining.
"Get up that ramp," Harris shouted. "We're exposed out here. I can't see the enemy. They must be cold-faced bastards."
I jogged up the ramp, holding my weapon at my hip. I adjusted the spread to form a broad cone and stepped into the gloom at the top. Lights. There should be lights. Someone had shut them off or smashed them all. Harris and Leeson were right behind me, breathing hard. About a dozen more troopers came up behind them. For me, the combat situation was an odd one. I'm accustomed to fighting aliens. My experience came from Cankri 9, Steel World, where the enemy were all in the form of very large lizards. These were men I was fighting against today, and this wasn't a drill. I was on their planet, and despite their lack of armor or heavy weaponry, I knew they could effectively kill my kind. I turned my suit lamps up to full power and disengaged the night vision. Clearly, the damned infrared input wasn't working. What I saw then was shocking. We were surrounded. They were all around us. Some crawled on all fours on top of the jump seat racks. Others hid behind the rows and were even coming up behind us on careful padding feet. They wore green-black outfits. That was something I hadn't seen before. I didn't know what they were at first. But the way their suits moved and shifted, they had to be smart cloth. Nanites, I thought. Of course, if the colonists were masters of a single technology, it was nanotech. They had tight-fitting suits, which concealed their bodies even from infrared signatures. The suits must cool the exterior or operate with some other chameleon effect. All I could see were their eyes. The rest was pure green-black. In a way, the fact that they startled me helped me out. I didn't hesitate. If I'd been given time to think, I might have delayed my fire for a fraction of a second, and that moment of indecision might have been fatal. But I didn't. I sprayed those that were in front of me, sweeping them with a broad cone of plasma-like violet fire. "They're all around us!" I shouted as those in front of me flickered in flame and withered away to smoldering corpses. I swept to the right and left, singeing the enemy that hid behind the rows of jump seats. Harnesses, gear, and even seats themselves caught fire, burning and producing black, oily smoke. I heard a great deal of commotion behind me, but I didn't have time to worry about that. The survivors in front of me rallied and charged. They were brave. I had to give them that. I'd read up a bit on the colonists we'd sent into space last century. They'd been hardy souls. They were people who were bright, tough, and who'd also apparently been irritating enough to the gathering world governments to warrant being shipped out into the unknown. Three of them rushed me. They couldn't have known that I was unable to fire my weapon again so quickly, but they came on anyway. I dropped my cannon as there was no time to cycle up the next blast. I flicked on the force blades in the arms of my suit, and these weapons met the nanite-edged black weapons of the enemy. It was one type of high-tech blade against another. Mine had more reach, but theirs were no less deadly. The first man who came at me did so without finesse. He howled and cut at me. I met his twisted blade with my own beam of force, and his disintegrated. My left arm thrust upward and swept high, a classic follow-through movement I'd learned on my first day of heavy infantry training. His head popped off and flew away, steaming. Witnessing this fight gave the other two colonists pause. To their credit, they didn't run. They came on with greater caution, trying to feint and jab at a distance. They didn't want their blades to touch mine. They wanted them to touch my armor. Fighting two enemies at once isn't easy. I was far from a master with force blades, but I like to think I knew what I was doing. The guy on the right sprang close, jabbed, then hopped backward. I made the mistake of going after him, and then the second fighter made her move. She slashed at my chest, which was lucky for me. The nanites left a long streak of dark metal as if she'd hit me with a charcoal stick. They dribbled and bubbled there, trying in vain to eat their way through my armor. I pulled a move that neither of them was expecting.
I extended my right force blade. Force blades aren't made of anything physically tangible. They are massless energy, plasma fields that can reach out 10 feet or more. Instead of a short wand, I suddenly possessed a lance. I thrust it through the retreating man and cut him down. I'll never forget the look on his blacked-out face. His eyes were so wide, I realized as he fell that he was a real person, a man who believed he was fighting terrible invaders. Worse, he was right. The woman howled and came at me, slashing and cutting. I didn't have the heart to gut her as well. I crashed my fist down upon her head, and she crumpled. She was hurt, but alive. I kicked her nanite weapon away from her and turned around. The scene behind me was shocking. Leeson was down, but Harris, Keevy, and two others had survived. They hadn't seen their attackers at first and had let them get in from the sides. Hacking at the joints, the enemy had managed to kill most of the platoon. Veteran Harris looked around and realized he was in charge.
"Damn," he said. "Looks like the last of them have run off, but we have to be more careful, people. How did you spot them, McGill?"
"Just turn off your night vision. They're using it to hide from us. They're more visible with suit lights and regular optics." We made the adjustments, and we pressed forward.
"Stay on point, McGill," Harris said. "We have to head up to the bridge. We can't let them take this lifter."
In my opinion, it was pretty clear they had already taken the ship, but no one was asking me. I pressed ahead, and we swept the hold. There was nothing left alive.
"Crazy ninja bullshit," Harris complained. "An entire unit was stationed here to protect the ship. They must have crept in while we had our pants down and slaughtered everyone."
"The revival unit will be working overtime," Keevy said.
"Yeah," I agreed, "if they haven't captured it."
Harris's eyes bulged at the idea. "We can't allow that. Let's roll, people. Retract the ramp so they can't come in behind us, then we'll clear the rest of the ship."
We grouped up and passed over bodies, banging our steel boots down as we tried not to walk on them. A few injured people moaned. We had no time for them, friendly or otherwise. We had to get control of the ship. We headed to the tube that led up to the crew quarters. I only hesitated for a second before climbing up there. I figured there might very well be a full squad of bullshit ninjas up there waiting to cuff my limbs. But hesitating wasn't going to save me. I was on point, and the enemy had to be defeated. The last few feet, I threw myself upwards, heaving into view on the deck above. I'd hoped to surprise whoever might be up there, but there was nothing to see, except the dead. A vicious fight had occurred on the upper decks, that was clear. There were dead bodies everywhere, many still locked in fighting positions. As far as I could see, no one had made it out. Harris bumped up after me. He looked around grimly.
"They must have fought to the finish. No way out up here. The emergency exits all are on the first floor. They sealed the tubes and swept the command deck. Clearly the colonists won, and the survivors ambushed us as we boarded."
"Why didn't they signal for help?"
Keevy asked.
"Comm system is down in the ship," Harris said. "Check your tappers, people. We'll have to fix that. If these colonists know how to sabotage a ship, they're smarter than I thought they were."
I had to agree with him. I walked to the hatchway at the end of the main passageway.
"Don't tell me,"
Harris said as we pressed inside and looked around. A stream of curses followed. I didn't blame him. The room contained nothing but corpses. Anne Grant was among the dead, as were several other bio-specialists and a few colonist fighters. But the worst part was the revival machine. It had been stabbed and cut with black blades. The interior guts of the machine looked damaged to me.
"This is bad. Really bad," Keevy said.
No one argued. We knew she was right. We needed our revival machines more than any other piece of equipment in the Legion. Without them, every death we suffered was permanent. "We've got to copy everyone to the other ships," I said. "They're all as good as permed otherwise."
"Hold on,"
Veteran Harris boomed as people began working on the comm gear.
"Keevy, You call this into the Tribune. McGill, you take the rest of them and sweep this deck. I don't want to see any other ninjas jumping out of the shadows at me.
We split up and looked around. We soon determined that, except for the wounded, we were alone on the lifter. We captured the wounded enemy and secured them in jump seats. We made our own people as comfortable as possible. I picked up one of the black blades and showed it to Kiwi. Her lips pulled away from her teeth as she eyed that twisting edge.
"It's like this blade is alive," she said. "Such a nasty way to fight. They use metal poisons to kill us."
"Can you blame them?" I asked her. She frowned at me.
"Whose side are you on, McGill?"
"I'm on humanity's side. We're all the same species. You understand that, don't you?" She nodded and looked down.
"Yeah. But it's hard not to hate them, even though this is their world. Our people might be permed, our entire unit, James, and the lifter crew, too. Their data was on this ship, and odds of recovery aren't looking good."
"Well, it's like Graves says, if you don't like getting hurt, don't start a fight." We were all upset. This wasn't supposed to happen. We were Legion Varus, and these people were a crowd of colonists. We didn't like killing them, but we liked dying even less. The thing I was most surprised about was the ability of these colonists to fight. How had they learned the art of warfare and become such tough fighters? We slept the lifter twice, but found nothing. Outside, everything looked quiet, until shells began to fall on the cliffs on the other side of the lake. Turov's bombardment began with a growing series of flashes on the shoreline. They lit up the water with wavering reflections in a display I might have found pretty if they weren't heralding destruction. I knew it was only light artillery, as we hadn't had room to bring the heavy stuff on the lifter during our hasty exit from Corvus, but our light guns were enough to do the job. They wouldn't level a town, but they hit much harder than my shoulder-mounted plasma cannon. The shells arced upward at a 45-degree angle, then performed a right-angle turn high in the air and crashed down into the cliffs. Each impact resulted flashes of blue light. The shells were both guided and independently smart. What they lacked in punch, they made up for in accuracy. Under normal conditions, they were designed to hit armored vehicles from above. Today, they were being used to go over the jumbled boulders and crash down upon defenders hiding behind them. Each salvo shot up, then slammed down again like a spiked volleyball a second or two later. The impacts created booming reports that echoed across the valley. In the lake, great numbers of rockfish surfaced to watch with their wart-encrusted optical organs. After careful examination via the lifter's outside scopes, we saw no sign of the attacking colonists.
"The enemy must be ducking and trying to ride this out," Harris said at my side.
"I agree, Vet. We should stay buttoned up, too." Once we were sure the lifter was free of the enemy, we all got to work repairing vital systems. We reported our status to the Primus, who was out marshaling the cohort at the base of the cliffs on the other side of the lake. Harris gave me the job of reporting, I think because he didn't want a disaster of this magnitude associated with his name. "Primus Turov," I said, making sure I wasn't talking to a flunky.
"Who is this?" she snapped. "I'm in the middle of an assault. A priority call had better be worth my time."
"Sir, this is Specialist James McGill. I'm at the lifter, and I have bad news."
"McGill, where's your commander?"
"Our officer is dead, sir."
"Then get off this line and put on the lifter's pilot."
I took a deep breath. "I'm sorry, sir. The lifter crew is dead. So are the bio people and the ship's garrison." There was a brief pause.
"What are you talking about?"
"The colonists attacked the lifter just before we hit them at the cliffs. They took it, but with heavy losses. Leeson's platoon was able to retake the ship, but we're down to a handful of effectives."
"Are you telling me you're the highest-ranking survivor on that ship?"
I glanced up at Veteran Harris, who was watching closely while he pretended to work on the ship's alarm system.
No, sir. Veteran Harris survived. He's repairing the ship's warning system to—
put him on.
Veteran Harris winced and worked his tapper in resignation. He joined the channel.
Primus Turov, he asked. Has McGill reported our situation?
Silence!
Turov shouted. I could tell she was at the end of her patience.
I'm transferring you up to the Tribune. Make your report to him.
Harris and I looked at one another in alarm. We waited, and a few minutes later, Tribune Drusus joined the line. The instant he did, Turov disconnected. I'm going to ask questions, Drusus said. I don't want any excuses, just data.
Understood, Tribune, Harris said.
Are you under attack now?
Negative, sir. The enemy...
Next question. Is your revival unit operating? Harris hesitated.
We have a tech working on it. The unit was damaged by the enemy.
Damaged? How?
They appear to have stabbed it, sir. They have these, I don't know, black swords with nanite blades. They can cut through our armor if they hit the non-metal components. Once a little of that metallic glitter is inside your flesh, it eats away at you.
Interesting, Drusus said. I'm surprised these isolated colonists have tech like that. It's an expensive import. But of course they don't know about imports and exports. They just make whatever they want, and to hell with the regulations. Their list of violations must be incredible. I thought about what he was saying, and I quickly realized he was probably right. In the Galactic Empire, a planet couldn't produce anything that other member worlds also produced and sold without going through a rigorous procedure to prove the new product was better than anything produced by the current patent holders. The truth was, Earth hadn't invented much in the way of new tech since the Galactics had come to our star system. Maybe that was the way they wanted it.
McGill,
shouted Drusus suddenly, bringing me out of my thoughts.
Are you on this channel? My tapper says you're here, lurking.
Yes, sir, I said.
I'm here.
You are hereby ordered to get that revival unit working. Stay on the lifter and work with the tech until it starts popping out fresh troops.
But, sir, I asked, I don't know how to operate the system, and all the bio people are dead.
Figure it out. Grow a bio first and get their help. I must have looked sick at these orders, because Harris was grinning at me.
Harris,
Drusus barked.
Sir.
Keep the enemy off that lifter. I'll have Turov send a unit back to support you. Hold out until they get there. Do you have any questions?
Tribune, I asked. What about the other valleys? How are things out there?
We're holding out, he said noncommittally.
How long until we can expect relief, sir?
Harris asked. You're on your own for now. Expect nothing from the other cohorts. I've grounded all the lifters.
Can I ask why that's the case, sir?
Harris asked. Drusus was quiet for a second.
There's a ship coming. The techs we left on Corvus spotted it, and now we have as well. The configuration is unknown. I don't want to fly any of our lifters up out of these valleys until we know the score. Our landing ships don't have much in the way of weaponry.
Harris nodded, grimly twisting his lips. I could tell he was worried. The Tribune signed off, and the connection broke. I looked at him. Another ship?
That's what the man said.
Who do you think it is? I asked. Squids? Galactics?
I have no idea, McGill. If the Tribune wanted us to know, he'd have told us. Now we need to...
I got to my feet.
Where the hell are you going?
Harris demanded. To help Natasha. Those are my orders. He grumbled, but let me go. Left with only two able-bodied grunts, he had a lot of bodies to sort through and a lot of equipment to check. I headed straight to Natasha's side, where she was working on the revival machine. She jumped up and came around with a pistol in her hand when I pushed the hatch open. Fortunately, she recognized me before firing.
Sorry, she said. I'm jumpy. These biomachines, they creep me out.
I don't blame you, I said, stepping carefully over the gory deck to her side. I poked at the biological innards of the revival machine. To my surprise, it shivered at my touch. Revival machines are probably the strangest things I've ever encountered. They looked sort of like old-fashioned pot-bellied furnaces on the outside. But instead of producing heat,
They formed flesh out of raw materials. They were metal on the outside with a data entry panel over the primary exit maw, but inside, they were as fleshy as the people who came back to life inside them.
"How does this damn thing work, anyway?" I asked.
"I don't have a clue," Natasha admitted. "This isn't our kind of technology. Human technology is pretty much machine-based. We have some biotech and can handle things like viruses, medicines, and surgery. But this is like understanding your own reproductive system and having full conscious control over every aspect of it."
"It seems to be alive," I said.
"Yes, these units are very hard to kill. I used a small EMC blast to kill the nanites, and I've been using flesh printers to heal the wounds, but the unit is in shock. The internal nervous system is giving me nothing but warning lights. I've tried to get it going by charging all the plasma bays and injection ports, but they still register as empty."
I looked the machine over carefully. I couldn't help but curl my lip in disgust. If you've never worked in a slaughterhouse with animal guts all over the floor, you probably can't imagine the smell and the mess.
"I still don't get how it can make any person it wants to,"
I commented as I tried to help her.
"Controlling biological output isn't new," Natasha said. "Some species on Earth can control their biological output, you know,"
Natasha said as she poked and prodded, trying to get the machine to operate. So far, most of the indicator lights were a cautionary yellow, and a few were red.
"Like what kind of animals?"
"There are hundreds of mammalian species in which the female is capable of manipulating the sex of her offspring."
I looked at her, my eyebrows upraised in surprise.
"Why would they do that?"
"Strategic reproductive reasons. For example, a strong female that's likely to produce an attractive male will select sperm that will grow into a male. But weaker females play it safe and are more likely to produce female offspring."
My jaw sagged a bit.
"Really? Can you do that?"
She blushed and turned away. I smiled and went back to tapping around under the dripping innards of the machine.
"It would be a neat trick if you could," I said. "If you want to give it a shot, I'd be willing to donate..."
"Shut up," she said.
"Forget I said anything."
I did shut up, but I found forgetting her words to be an impossible task.
"Ants can do it too, can't they?"
I said a minute or two later.
"What?" "A queen ant. She can decide to make soldiers if she needs them, or drone males, or even new queens."
"Yes, they have that ability. But this tech is so far beyond anything of that kind. I suspect it's done through extremely long organic molecular chains, through programming, essentially, that can grow cells to order by creating DNA and allowing natural cell division to take place. Compared to our biotech, it's as advanced as a computer is to a shovel."
"I get that," I said. "I can understand how these machines could build a cell to order and start incubating it. What I don't get is how they work so damned fast. It takes less than an hour for a full-grown human to come out of one of these. I don't see how that's possible."
Natasha frowned at the machine.
"That's been puzzling me as well. But I think I know the answer. They use time dilation. There's some kind of stasis field that operates to speed up time inside these units. It's the only answer I can think of."
"If you're right, these machines are incredibly advanced."
She nodded.
"Any luck down there?"
I came out from under the machine and wiped away goo.
"Not really. I suggest we take a tried and true approach."
"Name it."
"Let's cycle off the power. Turn it off and on again. The system needs a reboot."
Natasha shook her head worriedly.
"That might not work," she said. "What if we kill it? They have an internal source power and they never get switched off. You can't just stop a person's heart and start it again without knowing what you're doing."
"Well, what do you suggest then?"
I asked. She heaved a sigh.
"I think we're going to have to wing it. We're going to have to operate the machine despite the fact every indicator is scrambled. A few are green now, but most of them are still yellow."
I stared at her for a long second.
"I don't like that idea, but I have to admit we're less likely to kill the thing by accident that way.
Should we contact the other bio people and inform them of our plan?
She asked. I eyed her, then shook my head. I don't think so. They'd totally freak out. They did everything they could to get me permed the last time I messed with their equipment.
I know they're a little jealous of their tech, Natasha said, but this is a matter of life and death.
They just say we should wait until an authorized operator got here, I said. As soon as I'd spoken those words, they sounded like pretty good advice to me. Natasha's face became stubborn. I realized then that she wanted to run this machine. She was tech, not bio, but she'd built her own life form in college and been punished for it. She had a streak of curiosity about technology, any kind of technology.
Let's just do it,
she said quietly, as if whispering a secret.
The Tribune ordered us to. We'll stand on that.
I wasn't sure that would fly with the bio people. Some of them could be downright crazy. But I was game to give it a try anyway. I stood up and approached the data terminal. That was the one piece of this monster that looked familiar to me. The aliens who'd made this contraption had sewn in an interface on it that we humans felt at home with, and I, for one, thanked them for their thoughtfulness. I wouldn't have enjoyed the experience of stimulating its nerve endings manually to get it to do what I wanted. Instead, there was a touch screen, a keyboard, and even a few buttons. Cracking my knuckles, I reached for the terminal. Natasha put her hands on mine and pulled me away, the way a mother might have removed a toddler's hands from the knobs of a stove.
Let me do it, James,
she said gently. I nodded. She was the tech, after all.
Who are you going to revive first?
I asked. Natasha licked her lips.
No choice there, really. I'm going to have to bring back Specialist Grant.
I grimaced. The choice made sense, of course, and was the one who would have had the best chance of repairing the machine and getting it back to normal. But I didn't like the idea of doing that to a friend.
What if it goes wrong?
I asked Natasha.
You mean, what if she's a bad grow?
I nodded. We were both speaking with lowered voices. We weren't bio people. We still had hearts and stomachs that were built of flesh, not iron.
Don't think about it,
I advised her.
Just do it. We don't have any choice, really.
Natasha reached for the controls and began to tap at them. I watched with a growing sense of unease. Chapter 18. Anne's revival took many long minutes. The alien machine gurgled and hissed as it suckled on tanks of liquid and sent up odd vapors that lingered near the ceiling. During that time, the bombardment along the cliffs had shifted. The Primus wasn't getting the results she wanted, I figured, and was now walking her cannons across the walls of the valley, blasting apart rock where she imagined the enemy might be hiding. For their part, the colonists weren't reacting. They hadn't made any more attacks. But they hadn't surrendered, either. When the revival machine finished its strange incubation process, the primary maw yawned open. I hunted around for the scoop you were supposed to insert to help slide the body out. Natasha gave a little shriek, and I turned back in alarm. She was crouching in front of the steamy maw looking inside. She shined her flashlight into the dark opening.
I can see her feet in there,
she said with a noticeable degree of fascination in her voice.
Bare feet. And they look normal.
Aren't babies supposed to come out head first? I asked. Maybe we've screwed up already.
Just get the shovel thing. We have to get her out of there or she might suffocate.
I realized right then we had absolutely no idea what we were doing. We were criminally incompetent. Without a bio to help out, we might as well have been two cavemen trying to operate a computer. Only in this case, a human being's life depended on us. I approached with the shovel-like tool extended in front of me. It looked like one of those things they used to take pizzas out of ovens. It had a handle and a flat metal scoop in front. But this tool was longer and had a tip that was wrapped in soft polymers. I imagined this was to prevent tearing up the soft internals of the machine, or the newborn human. Sliding that scoop in there was a teeth-gritting experience all by itself. Natasha tried to help, lifting Anne's bare feet with her hands and said,